Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. It is the first Wednesday of the month, and it has been our tradition and our pleasure on this program for a long time on the first Wednesday to be talking about food and cooking. And generally with this guy, if you're a regular listener, you know him. This man we like to call our chef in residence. His name is Doyle Moore. Not really a chef, but a guy who's always been really interested in cooking and in the kind of stories that go along with the food that we love. And he's been with us monthly for a long time to do these shows. Every once in a while, he's off, and he's off traveling this month, and we expect to see him again next month. But we wanted to stay with the focus of cooking on the program. And we are doing that this morning with a special guest, and her name is Fran McCullough. She has discovered, edited, and published many of the country's most distinguished cookbook writers, and she is the editor of a recently published book, well, fairly recently published at least, entitled The Best American Recipes 2003-2004, and it is the fifth in a series of these kind of books that collect together recipes that have been published in cookbooks, in magazines, both the cooking magazines and more general magazines, newspapers, the internet. She and her co-editor, Molly Stevens, have gone out and done a lot of harvesting of recipes looking for good things and put them all together in this book. And indeed, I think there are a lot of good recipes in it. It's published by Houghton Mifflin and is in the bookstore if you want to go out and take a look at it. Questions certainly are welcome. Maybe you have a recipe you'd like to share or something to discuss that has to do with cooking. You can give us a call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that's good. Anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Ms. McCullough, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Sure.
We appreciate it. How did you get interested in a professional sense in cooking?
Well, I got extremely interested in food itself as a kid. My father was in the Marine Corps, and just after World War II, we were living on an island in the Pacific, and we had powdered eggs, which were pretty disgusting, powdered milk. It was a tough go there for 2.5 years. And when we came back to the States, I went to my mother's family farm in Iowa. And that was just amazing. They were churning their own butter and having fresh cream and killing the chickens, making homemade noodles. And I just couldn't get over it. Food really tastes incredible when it's good. So I focused heavily on that thereafter.
Mm. Well, the thing about food and people who are interested in food, the real true foodies are kind of thrill seekers in the sense that they are, I'm sure like anybody, they like their comfort foods, but also they're always looking for things that are new.
Yeah.
And new and interesting tastes that they've not had before. Maybe it's some kind of new ingredient. Maybe it's a cooking from some place that they've never been. But that's sort of the thing. It's always, well, what's really new and exciting? And certainly things like that is a driving force in the restaurant world because
yeah.
They're always looking for new things to offer their customers. So if I ask this question about, well, in this particular year, sort of in the last year, if you look at some of the trends that you see in the world of food, what is there something that really describes where we are right now with cooking, what people are really excited about?
I think spices are definitely at the top of the list. And, you know, even 5 years ago when I first started these collections, if you said Spanish smoked paprika or even chipotle powder, people would go, huh?
Yeah, what's that?
I'm not dealing with that. I don't know where to get it. I don't know what it is. And these things have sort of wormed their way into a lot of kitchens. And, they're instant gratification.
Yeah.
Cardamom, spice that people had in coffee cake, maybe. But we're starting to see it everywhere now.
Hmm. The chipotle is a smoked jalapeno chili.
Yes.
And you can get it either dried or you can get it in a sauce that's called adobo, and that's kind of a sweet, vinegary, spicy sauce that has a number of different seasonings in there. And they're, I don't know, I suppose for people who are dedicated chili fanatics, they might disagree, but I guess I would say that chipotles are pretty hot. At least for me, they're pretty hot. And they do definitely have a smoky flavor to them. That's one of the nice things about them. I guess I did not know that there was such a thing as smoked paprika. I don't remember ever having seen it actually on a shelf to buy. Tell me about smoked paprika.
Well, this comes from Spain, from a particular area of Spain where they always smoke the paprika peppers, and it's just delicious. It's much more subtle than chipotle. And not so hot, although there is a hot version. It comes in hot and mild. And its official name is Pimentón de la Vera. La Vera is the valley where they do this. And it's really, really good.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, just not all that long ago, just in the store sort of by accident, I came across smoked sun-dried tomatoes.
Yeah.
And which I liked a lot. And when I tasted them, the first thing I thought was, well, this reminds me of chipotle, except it's not hot.
Yeah.
And I thought that was, you know, so I started thinking about maybe using them in some of the same kind of ways with some of the same kind of flavorings. And so getting some of that quality, but without that heat that can be pretty strong.
Yeah, it can be. That's true. I love to buy those little cans of chipotles in adobo and just whiz them up in the food processor. And they keep for, 6 months in the refrigerator. Mm. And you just use a little bit with, say, some mayonnaise and a little lime juice, and you have a wonderful little sauce for shrimp or almost anything.
Yeah, that doesn't. And as I think about it now, I guess it does seem to be one of those ingredients that you see more and more in glazes for roasted or grilled meat, in dipping sauces like that. That it's one of those things that within the last couple of years is it becoming a much more common ingredient, or at least commonly called for in recipes.
Yes. That, yeah, you're right. Call for it doesn't mean people are actually doing it.
Do you have do you have off the top of your head a recipe that uses the smoked paprika, or have some idea about ways in which it's used?
Uh-huh. Let's see. I'm just I'm looking at chipotle at the moment. There's a recipe in this year's book for cornbread salad with grilled sausage and spicy chipotle dressing. It's pretty hot. It's got tomatoes, avocados, red onion, cilantro, sausage, grilled sausage, and leftover cornbread, toasted cornbread. And then there's just an olive oil, lime juice, chipotle, cumin dressing. And they have a quarter of a cup of chipotles in this dressing for four people.
That's I don't know about you. You know, if you like hot stuff, some people might be jumping up and down and saying, yay, but it seems to me that's an awful lot of chipotle.
Yeah, I think for four people, it kind of takes your head off. So,
yeah.
So we also give a suggestion that you might want to
get to cut back on that just a little bit.
Yeah. But last night, for instance, I made some shrimp. I just sautéed them in olive oil with a lot of garlic, and I put just a little bit of this smoked paprika in toward the end, and it just pulled it all together, and I squeezed a little lime over them when they were done. They were very, very good. Wonderful with eggs.
It sounds really interesting. I'm going to have to go out and see if I can find some of this stuff and see what it would be like. And maybe I should give my chipotles a chance again and just
calm it down a little
bit. Because that was that particular recipe for the cornbread salad is one of those that you list in your top 10 out of the book. And it really does look good. It does look like it has a lot of good flavors.
And it's, you know, something we love to find is unusual stuff. that when you serve it, people say, oh, this is incredible. What is this? You know, and cornbread salad is one of those things.
Yeah.
And it really delivers. It's extraordinary.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Fran McCullough. She is a cookbook editor. She is the author of a number of bestsellers herself, including the Low Carb Cookbook and Living Low Carb, and is the editor, along with Molly Stevens, of the book The Best American Recipes 2003-2004. It's published by Houghton Mifflin, and it's a book that this is now, it's the fifth one of these that you've done, is that
yes.
right?
Yes.
Okay.
And the sixth will be out in October.
Oh, so that'll be 2004-2005.
Yes.
Okay.
And we're working on the seventh.
Okay. Well, it's really I like the concept of somebody who spends a lot of time looking at recipes, just kind of going out and seeing everything that's out there and doing a cull and going through and then trying them and seeing which ones seem to really appeal and putting them together in the book. And I do think that there are a lot of recipes in here that look pretty tasty to me.
Oh, good.
And we do have a caller here, so let's bring them into the conversation. Listening, sure. Someone listening in Downs, our line number four. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Like you, I like to use the chili and adobo sauce and blend it up and then just put it in the refrigerator so I can just scoop out a bit and use it instead of dealing with those slimy chilies. but, David, you might like this. Often when I'm using chipotle, then I'll use some of the smoked paprika just to spice up that smoky flavor a little bit without having to use so much chipotle.
Oh, I think it's a good idea. I do really like the flavor. I think it tastes good to me. It's just that I'm...
Right, it's pretty hot.
It's pretty hot.
Yeah. And so there are lots of things. I like to make pasta with vegetables and then stir in goat cheese at the end and just a little bit of chipotle and a little bit of the smoked paprika, and that really kind of adds a subtle flavor if you don't put too much in. You can use too much of the smoked paprika.
Mm. That's true.
Pretty easily, and then it gets a little overpowering. But,
and if you burn it, you really don't like that taste.
Oh, I've never done that.
No, you would never.
Will.
You would never burn your smoked paprika? Of course not. Of course not.
I made pork tenderloin last night, and I made a marinade with soy sauce and hoisin sauce and smoked chipotle in adobo sauce.
Mmm.
Yeah, that sounds good.
And garlic and a little sesame oil. I keep
good.
Adding things here for you. But that makes a very nice marinade for a pork tenderloin.
And did you then grill that?
Yeah.
The outside grill?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great cut of meat for grilling.
Oh, yeah. Very good.
But look for the smoked paprika. World Harvest Food probably has it.
All right.
It comes in a pretty little red tin, at least what I buy does.
Very good. Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Other calls are certainly welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I do like pork tenderloin myself. I find, I think in our house, we've been probably using an awful lot, much, much less beef, but that's a cut that we really like. It's not terribly expensive. There's no waste. You can do all kinds of things with it. I think it's a really good thing.
Yeah, as long as you don't dry it out, but if you put the marinade on it, the way she was talking about, then you're fine.
Yeah. Well, let's say we have someone here in Champaign to talk with, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm one of those people who's pretty much a hot pepper freak, and I actually, David, find the chipotle peppers to be kind of mild. So
I knew there'd be somebody out there who would say, oh, what are you talking about, hot?
Yeah, that's me. Anyway, also, I'm also an avid gardener, so I grow a lot of these peppers in my backyard, and I find they even get hotter when they are fresher, too.
Hmm.
Really?
Yes. Oh, yes. There's nothing.
You know,
like
it's interesting because the commercial jalapenos, the fresh jalapenos, aren't very hot at all. Every now and then you get one that's hot, but often I have to use so many of them to get any kind of heat at all.
Well, right. And plus you can, but in your backyard, you can grow all these neat different kind of peppers, like little Thai peppers and habanero peppers, which are you know, the world's hottest peppers. And believe me, I've given people habanero peppers, and they've gotten blisters on their lips before. So, anyway, But my question is about another mild pepper. It's peperosini peppers, and I love the taste of peperosinis and Italian beef and all that. But I've never been able to find the seeds to grow a peperosini pepper anywhere, and I've grown over 100 different varieties of peppers in my backyard, and so I just wondered if you knew anything about that or what's the history on the peperosini pepper.
I don't, actually. I don't know that. Have you tried shepherd seeds? Do they
have? Yes, I have. I've Totally Tomatoes also just has a ton of pepper seeds, and so anyway, I just wondered if it. I think are they Greek or something? I just wondered if it's a region where they're grown versus an actual kind of pepper. But anyway, I just thought I'd call.
Actually, no.
Well, maybe there's somebody else who would be listening who would know.
That'd be great.
And it can call in and tell us.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Well, I thank you for the call. Other questions are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also do have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And we are talking with cookbook editor Fran McCullough, and the book that she has put together along with Molly Stevens is The Best American Recipes 2003-2004. And there will be, it's been going on now for a number of years, there will be one for 2005 and 6, and then for, I guess the next one would be 6 and 7.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, okay.
We're looking now.
Some of the things that you talk about in the book is, we're talking about the fact that people who are really interested in food, they're looking for things that are new and new tastes and things that they haven't experienced before. And I have to ask you here in the section where you talk about top trends for the year in food, where you say that the exotic cuisine of the year is British. Now, I have a lot of respect for the British, but you know that's always kind of been one of the big jokes is that the British are supposed to have the worst food in the world, and I'm sure that there are a lot of British cooks and chefs that would really bristle at that and put their dukes up and say, oh yeah, well you should come over here and come to some of our best eateries and we'll show you what good cooking is. So I'm sure that that's kind of unfair. At the same time, I'm sure a lot of people would still say, what? British is the exotic cuisine of the year?
Well, we're sort of sticking our tongues in our cheeks when we say that. But it's true. You know, we have, we've just ignored British food for decades just because it's been such a joke. And I have actually had some bad British meals. But when I go to England, 9 times out of 10, I have fabulous food. Really extraordinary food. They're very good at cooking excellent ingredients very simply, and it really pays off. They don't seem to have had a huge amount of influence from the French, which is kind of remarkable. But there is something very, very delicious about British food, and now we have Nigella Lawson and Jamie Oliver on our televisions all the time, and we've started to realize that they have a new way of, for us, new way of looking at these old dishes that is kind of exotic for us.
All right. Well, let's talk with someone else. We have a caller in Champaign on our line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm just calling about the peperosini seeds. There's one catalog that usually carries them. It's called Jung's, J-U-N-G. And they're in Wisconsin. I imagine they have a website. And then I bought plants this year at a little mom-and-pop greenhouse near Springfield. It's real near Camp Butler, just straight west of, a little bit west of Camp Butler. I don't remember the name, but I could maybe email you with the name and the address.
Yeah, if you come across it, you could do that, and then the other guy, if he's still listening, could get in touch with us, and we would pass it on.
I've only been there once. I just don't remember the name, but it's a really neat little mom-and-pop greenhouse that has a lot of unusual things.
So how your experience with the plants, did they do well?
This is the first year I've grown them, and I've only harvested a few, and I haven't tried putting them up in any way, so we'll see. I don't know if I'll be able to achieve the right taste or not.
Yeah.
Putting them up in vinegar or whatever you do.
Right. Well, I do come up here with a website for the Young Seed Company,
yeah.
J-U-N-G.
Yeah.
So that's if the other fellow who is listening, if he does have some internet access, he could try that.
Right.
And that's
they almost always carry them in their catalog, in the spring catalog.
Okay. It's just www.jungseed, youngseed.com. So
okay.
You can check that out.
Thanks.
Well, thanks very much for
Bye.
The tip. We appreciate it. Well, see, there you go. You pose some kind of question, and there's a pretty good chance that somebody listening actually has the answer. So that fella can go and check out that place on the web. And again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Do you have I asked you earlier about what are current food trends, and you said spices, and one of the things you mentioned was cardamom, which is, you know, maybe one of those things that people have on their spice rack and have never used, or maybe at Christmas time they have made something that has it in there. I knew somebody once who put it in their coffee who liked that.
Really?
And I don't know if that was something they had picked up in Scandinavia or something like that, but coffee was their they always put it in their coffee.
Yeah, I think that's something that happens in India also. I think I've had cardamom coffee in India.
And I grew to like it, although it was maybe slightly odd at the seemed slightly odd at the beginning. Do you have a recipe, something that again sort of occurs to you that uses cardamom?
Let's see. Shortbread made with cardamom is just delicious.
Mm.
Cardamom scented orange salad. That's kind of a wintry salad, but that is absolutely delicious. And it's just Valencia oranges and orange flower water, a little sugar, and a lot of cardamom seeds. And there are some dates and toasted flaked almonds and mint leaves, and you do it ahead and refrigerate it overnight, and take the cardamom seeds out before you serve it, and it's really refreshing and lovely.
Well, it does sound good, and you're suggesting this as a winter dessert.
Yes, especially during those holidays when, you know, you're just stuffed with rich food. It's a really nice treat. And they serve it with a honey yogurt with a little vanilla in it. It's also very good.
It does sound good. And it seems like the kind of thing that when you, in certain times of the year, you get into cooking certain things in certain ways, and then you just crave something that's really different.
Yeah,
something that just shouts of a different season, maybe, or of a different, you know, a different time. That's why in January, if you could get fresh basil, you'd want to have some pesto or something like
right.
that, because it's
right.
such a, or you'd like to have a plate of really nice tomatoes and fresh mozzarella or something like that with a little basil. That would be, see, it shows you that I'm an Italian that says. Yeah, my father would think that would be very funny. That says summer, just cries out summer, and I don't know.
I do that sometimes. I mean, I always feel kind of guilty when I do, but there are those wonderful little tomatoes from Canada. I think Sunset is the brand, and they actually smell like tomatoes. So when I'm snowed in and feeling sorry for myself, I sometimes do that, mozzarella, basil, and those little tomatoes. Yeah.
It's nice. It gives you just a little taste of summer in the depths of winter. Just like, I don't know, sometimes in July what I'd really like to have is beef stew or
something like that.
You want to make chili and fire up the oven and make cornbread because it's just you're so sick of it being hot and humid, like it is right now, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Right. So is it corn season?
Yes, here it is indeed. We have a very nice, in our community, we have a nice farmer's market, and you can go down there and get, we are in the time of year when you can get good sweet corn,
right.
Which is a great treat. That is one of those things that, I think people sometimes talk about the fact that it's sort of too bad that there aren't seasons anymore, that you can kind of get everything anytime, although that doesn't mean it's always going to be good. But it seems to me that this is one of those things that, no, it's still, there's this little window in the summertime, and you have it there, and you enjoy it, and then when it's done, you say, we're done. we're not going to have it until next year.
Right.
And you just have it right then. So, yes, now would be a good time.
I was talking to a geneticist, a plant geneticist last night, who said, you know, that super sweet corn, that was developed at the University of Illinois.
That is correct.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
That is correct. And I know that there are some varieties that actually, there's one famous variety, I think, that's called Illini Super Sweet, which was developed at University of Illinois. Uh-huh. And I don't know if that's, you know, if we can lay claim to being the creator of all the sweet corn in the world, but some of the solid varieties, yes, and it's a great thing when you can and you can get it, you know, as fresh as you possibly can. Actually, there's a fellow who frequently appears on this program who does a home maintenance show with me, and he also has some farmland and grows sweet corn. And I was really surprised one night a couple of weeks ago. He was so nice. He shows up on my doorstep one night. He knocks on the door with a huge bag full of sweet corn that had been grown on his field, and it was still warm. It was warm to the touch. It was that it must have been an hour out of the field, and it was lovely. And I shared some of it with my neighbors because there was no way that me and the missus were going to eat all of the sweet corn, and it was really, really good. So it's a really special sort of summer treat.
Something I wanted to ask your listeners who grow corn is, you know, there's this Mexican fungus called wheat lacoche that grows on corn. So, so delicious. And I think it has to be field corn. And I think here it's called corn smut.
That's right.
But I'm just wondering if anybody in your audience has it, has ever tried eating it, knows anything about it.
Well, we'll see. There have got to be some people who listen this morning who have some experience with growing corn and might be familiar with that. I know I have heard of it. I know what it is, but I've never had it. Have you had it?
Yes.
So
Mexico.
So what's it like?
It's kind of like truffles. It's just one of those incredibly heady, mushroomy things. It's a little like porcini or those things that we never get that they get in Europe all the time. But it's, you know, people throw out corn smut. I know that. And I know that Rick Bayless from Topolobampo in Chicago, he gets his from a farmer, I think, in Illinois. But he told me it was a special strain of corn, and it was treated in a special way. But
well, it's not one of those things that I've ever seen offered for sale. As you say, it would be one of those things where if you had it in your field, you wouldn't think this is great. Now have an opportunity to sell to the gourmet market. You think, oh my gosh, what am I, you know, I have this problem. We're going to have to throw this away. You know, and the idea that people would stand in line to eat it probably would seem kind of strange, but that's true. Just all depends on how you were raised, I guess.
Yeah, most of it here in restaurants is frozen, which isn't the best. I mean, it's still kind of interesting, but the real thing is pretty amazing.
Well, if there are any corn smut fans out there, you can give us a call. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We're a little bit past the midpoint here. Maybe I should introduce again our guest. Fran McCullough is a cookbook editor, and along with Molly Stevens is the editor of The Best American Recipes 2003-2004. It's now a book series that has been coming out for a number of years, and there will be more, at least one for next year and the year after that. And what she and her co-editor have done is gone through cookbooks and magazines and newspapers and just looked at an awful lot of recipes and picked out those that they thought were the best and published them in the book. And I do think there's some good sounding stuff in here. Houghton Mifflin is the publisher, and it's out there at the bookstore now, along with the other 50,000 cookbooks that you will find if you go to the bookstore. And so if you're curious here, you have some questions or have a recipe to offer, you can give us a call. To me, that is stunning. You're being in the business, you probably have some handle on how much that has grown.
The
number of books now that are available, it is just unbelievable.
Nobody actually counts cookbooks, strangely. but
really, as a special category of books, no one could tell you how many were published last year.
No, but it's many thousands, and most of them actually sell pretty well. I mean, there's a lot of compulsive cookbook readers.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot of fun, and I like looking at them and looking at cooking magazines. I guess I do find myself wondering, though, how many of all of the cookbooks that are sold, how many are ever cooked out of? I mean, really? Or maybe you get a cookbook and you make two things out of it. And
well, in the business, there is a sort of unspoken idea that if you get two or three good recipes out of a book, you're doing well. So one thing we're trying to do when we go looking is to spot those recipes and test them. Because, if you're paying $40, which is not uncommon these days, for a book, and you try a recipe and it's awful, which happens to us all the time, you're pretty mad.
Yeah. Well, and I'm just thinking, for example, that some months back I was looking at there was a cookbook that was put together by Marcus Samuelson.
Yeah.
Who is a very famous Scandinavian chef and has a restaurant in, I think it's in New York, one of the big deal places. And so he's done a cookbook that combines his various interests. It's certainly a Scandinavian influence, but there are other influences in his cooking. And it's a beautiful book. It's just beautiful. But I don't know that I could imagine making very many things out of it. And maybe, as you say, there might be, if I was feeling really ambitious, I might pick something and just say, well, let's try this and see how it is. It's a beautiful looking book, and the recipes look pretty interesting, but they also look sort of daunting.
Yes. Actually, in this fall's book, we have a Marcus Samuelson recipe, and we tested several and finally hit one that we loved. And I can't even remember what it is at the moment, but he's one of the people responsible for the cardamom boom.
That would make sense that he would.
Scandinavian. And, of course, his other big influence is Ethiopia, which is such an interesting blend, how he plays with those ingredients. That one thing that we're always looking for, all these chefs are producing books, and some of them are very hands-off. The chef doesn't really have much to do with the production of the book or the cooking or the recipes even. And so we're trying to weed out the good stuff, find the good stuff in those books. But something we love is when chefs cook at home, which not all of them do by any means, they cook simpler food, but they still have the same sensibility. So we look hard for those recipes.
Yeah. Well, I could imagine the chef coming home from a hard day of work and the family saying, "So, what's for dinner?"
What's for dinner?
And they would say, "Get out of here. Forget it. I don't want, cook. How about pasta anytime? Let's just put that in the microwave and have that come out."
Well, this fall, we have a recipe from Rocco Dispirito of the famous television show. And it's just heirloom tomatoes sliced thin with, I think there's four tomatoes, the zest of an orange, a large orange, scattered over the top, and some Spanish sherry vinegar with salt and pepper. That's it. And it's so good. There's no oil, no nothing. And he says, well, anything else would be an insult to the tomatoes. But it's so great to see something really simple and elegant. And I mean, it's wonderful for home cooks to be able to do that.
Well, it seems to me that's something that, and maybe that's not exactly new, but we've been seeing in the food world for a long time. And that is, sometimes you see dishes that are very, very elaborate. But then also there's the other end of the scale where things are simple. The preparation is simple. The ingredient list is not that long. It's not stuff that's really exotic. But it may indeed rely on being able to get really good, really fresh ingredients. And that's the catch. I mean, now at this time of year, maybe you can go to the farmer's market and you can get a lovely assortment of heirloom tomatoes if you're lucky. But not everybody is going to have access to the to what might be a key ingredient in a dish like that, it's the tomatoes. And if you can't get the tomatoes, you might as well forget it.
Right, right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I think people love to cook that way. At least I do, because after all, we're all incredibly busy. And I think it's, we do have some complicated recipes, and we really hold them to a high standard. They have to really deliver. They have to be worth it. So we try to mix up those two kinds of recipes.
Well, let's talk. We have someone else here to talk with in Edgar County, and this is our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
You were talking about corn smut.
Yes.
It grows on sweet corn.
It does.
Yes. Because when we used to grow corn, and we grew the super sweet, Eli and I, because I had a half-brother that was in the agriculture department up there.
Uh-huh.
So many, many years ago, started growing the stuff. And corn smut is an enlargement of the corn kernel itself. It's a fungus.
Mm-hmm.
And in Mexico, it's called huitlacocha.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't call it corn smut, though, in Mexico. They call it caca. So, and all you do with it is you just, you can saute it in butter. Or you can also mix it with scrambled eggs.
Mm.
And the problem is your scrambled eggs will be black, but that's, that's a small price to pay.
And have you done this?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Well, the thing is, when you have smut...
What are you going to do?
and the thing is, you just go with the flow. The thing is, I wanted to experiment, and I read about, having been in Mexico and such. And it really is... I think it kind of has, it is, as you said, it's a fungus, so it's a mushroom kind of taste to it. And it's a shame that people just throw the stuff away, because fresh should be quite good. I've never had it frozen, so I don't know about that.
Yeah, the frozen is not so good. It gets kind of watery.
Because that's what it is. Its consistency is primary water.
Yes.
By the way, have you heard of what is your thinking of a book called The Encyclopedia of Creative Cooking by Charlotte Turgeon?
I don't know that book.
Well, a friend of mine got this for me. Just recently, and it has 2,000 recipes.
Good grief.
Yes.
Is it a new book?
Oh, no. This book is from the 80s.
Oh.
But the thing is that she is the editor of La Russe Gastronome.
Uh-huh.
And also has the creative cooking course.
Oh.
And these are very simple recipes.
Huh.
They're not elaborate. They're not like the French cook, such as that. But they have meat casseroles, and they have puddings and desserts and seafood and pastry. But it's not difficult at all. And the thing is, it has 800 color photographs in it.
Gee.
And so I suggest you might take a look at it, because
good.
I love it. But you're also talking about the fact that it's one of those expensive books.
Yes.
But yet at the same time, these recipes, in reading them, you can find that they're very down to earth, and they have been tested.
Good. Not what you'd expect from La Russe.
Right. I mean, you don't have to go to that person that used to have a show on, I think it was on Channel 3, that's now going to prison, with baked macaroni and four cheeses.
Oh, right.
They've got it. It's nothing elaborate. It's just buying four different kinds of cheeses. I like the book. I've got probably 200 or 300 cookbooks.
Oh, boy.
Well, they go all the way back to my grandmother.
Uh-huh.
She collected cookbooks, and I've got them going back to 1890-something.
Gee, do you have a favorite?
My favorite, I would have to say, well, this one's becoming a favorite, but I'd have to say that the one that I really learned to cook with is The Joy of Cooking.
Yes.
That book tells you how to do things.
Yes.
And so that. And also another book which I like is James Beard.
Mm-hmm.
When I lived in New York, I got to meet him. And
I
have a signed copy of his cookbook.
Oh, great.
And, you know, so, and the thing is, he's very down to earth.
He is, yeah. He'll tell you how to, you know, how to do a shortcut or how to...
And he also gives you variations.
Yes.
Of the same basic recipe. And his American cookbook is the one I have.
Yes.
Which is, I think, just the very best. And also, I like the Frugal Gourmets.
I haven't cooked out of the Frugal Gourmet very much.
Pardon?
I haven't cooked out of those books very much.
Well, when he was on Channel 12 here,
mm-hmm.
why we, you know, watched him faithfully every Sunday. And, in fact, we got a couple of his books through the Pledge Program, Channel 12.
Uh-huh.
So, but anyway, I just wanted to ask you, I wanted to tell you about wheat lakocha.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the story.
The next time you're around a cornfield, you know, just go look. And you can break it off. You don't have to take the whole ear.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, just go break it off. I'm quite sure they won't
mind.
Sue you or you know, put you in prison for stealing smut.
That's great. I can't wait. I'm going up to the country this weekend.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Well, see, I was going to jazz you about asking you when the last time you were in a cornfield was, but it sounds like you have been in cornfields. So.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
all right.
Yeah. You know, it's funny when he was talking about how the four cheese macaroni turned up in this old book. Here we are. Looking through all these food magazines and cookbooks every year, and we see all these recipes and get all excited about them. And every now and then, I see food magazines from the 70s or the 80s or read old cookbooks, you know, the Vogue collection or something. And he's right. You know, these things that look so new and exciting, so many of them were done then.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not quite the same way, but pretty close.
Yeah, we made
some of our ingredients weren't available then. But
and we're probably a little bit more concerned with the lightness. Maybe we'd like to lighten things up a little bit. But other than that, it's sometimes it seems hard to find something that is truly new that nobody has ever done before.
That's true. Yeah.
We have about 10 minutes left, and we have a couple of other callers, so let's talk with them. Bloomington, Illinois is up next, line number one.
Yes, I had a question. Unlike your earlier caller who knew what to do with what he grew in the garden, I grow things in the garden before I know what to do with them. So right now I'm growing, it's a pineapple tomatilla.
Goodness.
So it's pineapple flavored, and they're nice. I mean, they're like tomatillas, I guess, although I've never grown them, the regular kind. It has a kind of pineapple-y flavor, and it's kind of crunchy and small, but I don't know what to do with it, so
except
pop it in my mouth and eat it.
Yeah, you can just cut up tomatillos and put them in salad. So I would think you could do the same, and it's hard to think what's good with pineapple and tomato.
Kind
of threw me when you said that. I thought, huh.
I would think that you could use that to make a kind of a relish or a salsa that would be good with either grilled chicken or grilled fish, maybe.
Fish, I was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because you get a sort of a, you know, now we see an awful lot of fruit salsas
mm-hmm.
to go with grilled meats with yeah. well, grilled fish, and I think you probably could do that with chicken, probably.
So would you add lime juice or?
Yeah, that I would think that would be good with those flavors.
And would you make a sauce out of it?
Mm-hmm. I would. I think I would keep it raw or cook it into a little sauce.
So that
it's
so crunchy.
Doing that too, just cooking it down with some onion and maybe some olive oil or some kind of oil.
Mm-hmm.
Make a little sauce. I wonder how it would taste in guacamole. You know, tomatillos cut up and mixed into guacamole. That's quite good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it would go with the avocado taste, sure.
Yeah.
You might just have to do some experimenting and kind of see what you come up with. And maybe just look for some recipes that use tomatillos and try the ones that you have.
Uh-huh.
And see how you like them. I mean, it's possible that you might make something and taste it and say, bleh, you know, but but then again, you might taste it and say, whoa, this is really very good. So you might have to just play around with it, because certainly there are a lot of recipes now that use tomatillos
uh-huh.
for sauces and salsas. So, you know, maybe also go down to the library or the bookstore and look for books, Latin, Mexican or South American recipes and see what might be in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, pork. Well, thank you for the suggestions.
Yeah,
sure.
Pork might be good with that combination, too.
Yeah, fruit flavors with pork would be nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, good luck.
Interesting.
Right, thank you.
Let us know how, if you have to think about it, if it works out, you know, let us know.
Okay.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Let's go here to another caller here with line number 2, and I believe the caller's in Urbana.
Yes, I was wondering if you had any interesting recipes for chicken that you've come across in your...
Chicken, you know, recipe. That's what our editor always says to us. What's the chicken recipe? She always wants to cook chicken almost every night. So there's always a chicken. And let me see what was in last year. There is a wonderful chicken braised with prunes, but that's kind of wintry. There's a recipe I'm very fond of called convent chicken. That's a very good dish for when it's hot. And it's chicken breasts, chicken legs, chicken thighs.
Just cut up.
Yeah, cut up chicken pieces. Low sodium soy sauce. It's a cup of that. Half a cup of fresh lemon juice. 2 tablespoons fresh tarragon chopped or 2 teaspoons dried. 2 teaspoons garlic powder. 1 teaspoon paprika. Half a teaspoon of pepper. And you just rinse the chicken and pat it dry, and you combine everything else and stick it in a bowl. And marinate it all.
Okay.
And sort of massage it into the chicken.
You can marinate it overnight then? Or?
Yeah, overnight is the best, but if you have 3 hours, that's okay too. And you turn it several times,
mm-hmm.
and you just grill the chicken skin side down. And you can also cook it in the oven. You can bake it, or, you know, if the weather goes, it'll be about 45 minutes at 375.
And what did you call that?
It's convent chicken. It's actually a recipe served in a real convent.
Oh, convent chicken.
Yeah, okay. In New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And it's very light.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, it's a wonderful, it's got all that lemon juice and the tarragon.
And you grill it on a hot fire for, what, about 30 minutes, or what's the...
Let's see, what do we say here? Place the chicken skin side down on the grill rack. If you're using a charcoal grill, move the chicken away from the hottest area. If you're using a gas grill, reduce the flame to medium-low. Cover the grill. Turn it frequently so that it cooks evenly and thoroughly. Should be ready in about 35 minutes.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Yummy.
Well, you know, we have just about exhausted our time, and we're going to have to stop. For people who are listening, obviously, if you're interested in looking for some good recipes, you might look for the book that we have been talking about, The Best American Recipes, 2003-2004. And there are a series of these books going back a few years now, and they'll continue. There'll be a couple of more. The book is edited by our guest Fran McCullough and Molly Stevens, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin. And Fran, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate your time.
This was fun. I'm so excited to learn about wheat locote.
Wheat locote. Go out there in the field and see if you can find some corn smut.
I'm going to.
All right. Thanks very much.
Okay. Thanks, David.
Bye-bye.
Bye.